From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Tony Awards ceremony will be broadcast Sunday night. Actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen will be given a special Lifetime Achievement Award. On today's archive edition, an interview recorded last year with Hagen about her more than 60-year career, in which she's worked with such theater legends as Eva Le Gallienne, The Luntz, and Paul Robeson. Her students have included Jack Lemmon, Sigourney Weaver, Matthew Broderick, and Lily Tomlin. Kevin Spacey is up for a Tony for his leading role in the Broadway revival of The Iceman Cometh. We'll hear an interview from 1991 before he became a movie star. And film critic John Powers reviews John Sayles' new movie, Limbo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Pentagon officials say the Western allies might stop bombing Yugoslavia as soon as this weekend, provided that Serb forces cooperate. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from the Pentagon.
NATO and Yugoslav military representatives meet Saturday morning to talk about how Serb forces will abandon Kosovo. Pentagon officials say the Serbs must agree to a schedule for the pullout. Their troops have to start moving on routes that NATO decides, while reconnaissance planes watch their progress. NATO hopes the Serbs take their tanks and artillery with them, since the alliance is hoping to disarm all sides in the province. At some undetermined point, when NATO decides the withdrawal is serious, the alliance will stop dropping bombs. Pentagon spokesman Ken Bacon says if the Serbs move quickly, it could take 2 to 4 days to arrange the bombing halt. It could take some days longer for all the Serbs to actually cross the border, since NATO has destroyed several bridges on a key highway leading out of the province. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, the Pentagon.
A federal jury is now considering civil rights charges against 4 New York City police officers accused in the brutal beating of a Haitian immigrant. The 4 white police officers are accused of depriving Abner Louima of his civil rights. A 5th officer, Justin Volpe, has already pleaded guilty to beating and torturing Louima. Today's the 10th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. While Beijing kept a tight clamp on public commemorations of the event, tens of thousands of people in Hong Kong gathered for a candlelight vigil. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Hong Kong is the one part of China where people are still free to mourn the hundreds, possibly thousands, of pro-democracy demonstrators who were gunned down 10 years ago by the Chinese military. Beijing claims that only a few people died in the crackdown, and most were soldiers. Chinese who were there know differently, but the government tightly controls information about the event. 2 men were detained near Tiananmen Square, one for opening a white umbrella that said, "Remember the student movement," the other for flinging pamphlets into the air. But in Hong Kong, the annual vigil in memory of Tiananmen went ahead. In a telephone link with the crowd, exiled former student leader Wang Dan said the dead of Tiananmen should inspire the next generation to reach for democracy. Mary Kay Magstead, NPR News, Beijing.
A federal appeals court ruled today that federal immigration authorities can revoke an immigrant's naturalized citizenship if it was obtained by fraud. The ruling could affect over 4,500 immigrants nationwide. Stock prices were generally higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 136 points. For the week, the Blue Chip Index was up 240 points. Broader market averages were also higher. The S&P 500 was ahead 28, and the NASDAQ Composite was up 75. You're listening to NPR News. Colombian right-wing paramilitaries freed a Colombian senator today who had been kidnapped 2 weeks ago in the city of Medellin. Stephen Dudley reports from Bogota.
Senator Piedad Córdoba said she spent the first several days of captivity in a cold basement. "I thought they were going to kill me," the senator said. As a member of the Senate's Human Rights Commission, Córdoba has been an outspoken critic of the paramilitaries for human rights violations. Córdoba is also a strong supporter of the peace process the government is carrying out with left-wing guerrillas, and she has met with rebel leaders several times. In a statement taking credit for the kidnapping, paramilitary leaders noted Córdoba's closeness to the guerrillas. They also demanded a spot at the negotiating table with the rebels. But upon her release, Córdoba continued her criticism of the groups and added that the paramilitaries were not ready to take part in the peace talks. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Dudley in Bogota.
President Clinton's recess appointment of James Hormel to be ambassador of Luxembourg is being criticized by the Senate leader. The nomination of Hormel, who is homosexual, has been opposed by conservatives for 2 years. Today's appointment uses a provision in the Constitution that allows the president to bypass the regular confirmation process during a congressional recess. It drew immediate fire from Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, but the head of a gay rights group said the appointment is a bold move by Mr. Clinton. Survivors and relatives of victims placed wreaths and flowers at the site of Tuesday night's plane crash at Little Rock National Airport. 8 charter buses carried some 300 people, some in wheelchairs and wearing neck braces, within about 100 yards of the crumpled remains of American Airlines Flight 1420. The plane crashed as it was landing, killing 9 people and injuring 83. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the Tony Award Ceremony Sunday night, Uta Hagen will receive a special Lifetime Achievement Award. I've heard many actors say with reverence that they studied at the HB Studio in New York, which she runs. It was founded by her late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in 1945. Some of the actors who studied there include Jack Lemmon, Stocker Channing, Matthew Broderick, Maureen Stapleton, and Lily Tomlin. Many actors have studied Uta Hagen's books, Respect for Acting and A Challenge for the Actor. Uta Hagen started her acting career over 60 years ago and worked with now legendary people including Eva Le Gallien, the Luntz, and Paul Robeson. She was born in Germany and moved to Madison, Wisconsin at the age of 6 when her father accepted a position teaching art history at the University of Wisconsin. I spoke with her last November when she was starring in the off-Broadway production Collected Stories. You're known as a great teacher as well as a great actor, and you've written a couple of books about acting. You write that there are hundreds of different people within you who surface through the day, within anyone who surface through the day. Do you recommend that actors find the person within them that's closest to the role that they're playing?
Well, it isn't one person in you. In other words, when you create a role, you are selecting from various aspects of your life and putting it together to create that new character. But all of that has to spring from your understanding of yourself. And that's what takes so long.
You say that an experience that has served you many times, including when you played Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire, is an experience from your childhood when you were like pelted with hard snowballs by kids in the neighborhood, and you were called an atheist. What is it from that scene that stayed with you so much, from that experience?
Well, it was a bitter, cold winter night. I was hounded through the streets with snowballs by children. That's terrifying. I never forgot it. It was like being in hell.
What is it from that experience that you summon up when you need to for a role?
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering if there is a kind of experience that is so frightening or rich for you, if you've used it to draw on several times for roles, does the experience dry up? Does it lose its power to have that energy for you?
As a matter of fact, that experience might wear out because I've talked about it a lot. If you don't talk about it a lot, it stays useful. When you explain to an audience, to somebody, a friend or, a colleague who's working with you, what sources you're using, if you tell them that, your secret is gone. Now they look at you with that knowledge of what you're using and judging it, and you can't use it anymore.
That's interesting. So you won't talk about these things with the people you're performing with?
No.
But you'll talk about it with your students?
Not what I'm using in the immediate role. I give them examples like the snowball.
Right.
Now that's used up for me because I've talked about it a lot.
In one of your books about acting, you talk about how you can't be inert on stage, and you have to find out what it is that you actually do while you think you're doing nothing, so that you could do that kind of thing on stage. Have you thought about that a lot, what it is you're doing when you're
I'm
really
going
doing
to interrupt
anything?
You right now.
Go ahead.
Because, again, everything you're discussing, you have read, it interests you. Are you an actor?
No, I'm not.
Then it's none of your business. Now, let me explain to you why. It may interest you, may fascinate you, but I feel that in the theater, everybody thinks they can act. Everybody is fascinated about another human being on stage. If it's very convincing, they usually are sure that they could do it too. which is not true at all. If you would go to a violinist, you would not ask him about his bowing arm, about his elbow position, about his phrasing. And if he told you, you wouldn't know what he's talking about, and you would be bored. If you went to a painting class and a watercolor class, and you saw a teacher showing somebody how to put how to wash a piece of paper that is going to have watercolor put on it in a minute, you'd say, "What are they teaching here? How they're watering down a page?" These are not the secrets, but the craft itself. You wouldn't ask a scientist because you wouldn't know what he was talking about. And you must, I feel, an audience should learn to respect acting as a craft in the same way that if I do explain it, it might titillate you. You might understand a little of it, but the real impact or import of it for a fellow artist, you would not get.
I don't
say that to offend you. I just believe that with all my heart.
I want to say I totally respect what you're saying, but I just beg to differ on a couple of things. That, for example, I would be asking the violinist about their phrasing and the bend of their arm and all of that.
Why?
Well, because I think...
Do you play violin?
No, but...
Then I think you might ask him, but I think the violinist would look at you like you were nuts, and I think you are.
No, see, what I have found as someone very interested in these things is that, for instance, if the violinist talks to me about his or her phrasing, it might help me hear music, hear things in music that I didn't hear before. I find that actually understanding more about craft is not only interesting in its own right, but helps me perceive things that I didn't perceive before, which I like.
That's a very valid point. And maybe I'm just in reaction to so many people who ask these questions the misunderstanding of the layman in terms of an acting technique are so profound that I think I've pretty much had it in my life with that. I think that's probably part of my rebellion.
I'll tell you another reason why I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about acting, though I respect you for not wanting to talk about this, is that I think really good actors have great insights into the body and how the body is used, how the body communicates, how the voice communicates, and also that great actors are great observers of other people, and they just have great insights into...
That's true.
How
and
people
I think,
move.
But you see, the body again, which I'm gung ho about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about it all the time, and I believe that the body as a instrument of communication is all powerful. And the biggest influence in my life for that training came from modern dance, without being balletic or dancerish, but it very strongly influenced me. However, very fine actors very often cannot define themselves what it is they are doing. Lorette Taylor could not tell you what she was doing. She had no idea. She was intuitive, instinctive, great performer.
I've certainly noticed that as an interviewer, that some of the really great artists I've interviewed...
Oh, God, some of the best ones And I happen to have because I've been teaching, and I found in my own work that very often... when I couldn't explain something, it was because I didn't understand it myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I couldn't articulate it, it was because it was fuzzy in my own head. Now, I do know that I can do it, nevertheless, but I may not be able to communicate it to someone else.
Perhaps you'll let me ask you about the voice, since I do speak on the radio.
Yes.
I know that... you've recommended singing lessons for people who aren't necessarily going to be singing on stage but are just going to be speaking. What do you feel you've learned about your voice from studying singing? I'm assuming you've studied it.
I did. You see, it's the same with when I say dance, modern mm-hmm. dance, for mm-hmm. the body of the actor, which does not make them self-conscious about stage movement but gives them a sense of alignment, a sense of... an awareness of their body and space. In the same way, singing, rather than voice for the theater, makes them not listen to themselves. It prepares the vocal instrument, the diaphragm, the whole tone of the voice in the head. Without making you now listen to yourself when you talk. Do you understand what I mean? The self-consciousness, when it makes you listen how it sounds, you're going to be a bad actor. The voice has to be there for you to serve you when the time comes.
Right. So you're not worrying about how you're doing your lines.
Exactly.
You're learning about the sound and physicality of your voice.
Exactly. It's there from the singing. It serves, the instrument is ready. It's primed.
We're listening to a 1998 interview with actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Sunday she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Your acting career was launched by what I perceive to be as a very bold gesture. When you were, I think, 17, you wrote a letter to Eve Le Gallienne asking if you could work with her.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very brave thing to do.
I didn't even think it was brave. I was also very stupid. I thought she still had the civic repertory, which I knew, had read a great deal about and heard about. And it was the only repertory company in America at the time. There hasn't been one since, I don't think, a real repertory company. And she was doing great plays and contemporary new playwrights and Ibsen and Chekhov and Shakespeare. And that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to be a part of that. And based on that, I wrote her and I said, this is what I want, and could I audition for you, and I want to be a part of your theater. And didn't realize that the Civic had already folded, and she was still functioning, but not in that capacity. And then she was working on a production of Hamlet, which I didn't know. And I went home after my audition with her, and in spring of 36. No, 37. And then my father wanted me to go to college, and because at that time you couldn't get a job at Macy's if you didn't have a degree. It was during the Depression. And I was itching to just go into the theater. I didn't want to do college. So I thought I'll do it in a 3-year plan and take summer school. And I went to enroll in summer school and came home, and there was a letter from Miss Le Gallienne asking if I would be interested in coming east and working with her on Hamlet. And that was my debut in the theater, Ophelia.
Now, was that letter based on her having seen you, or just based on your letter?
No, based on my letter.
What?
My letter to her.
What did you say in that letter?
I don't know.
That led to that invitation.
I really don't know how I used to persuade people that I was fabulous, because I guess I believed it. And I don't know how I interested. My agent said to me, who was my agent at the time, she said, I don't know, when you walked in, you knew you were great, so we believed it. And I don't think I had egomania at all. I just believed I had a big talent and I was going to be a great actress.
So what was it like for you playing Ophelia so early in your career?
I don't remember. You see, it's all like a haze and blur. It was a wonderful experience. And then in essence, I studied with her, because I worked with her in the play and that whole company with fencing lessons, and we had all sorts of extracurricular things we were asked to do. And we wove our own costumes at her looms. And it was a phenomenal experience for me. And then when that was finished, which went very well at Dennis, we played it in Dennis, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and got wonderful reviews from Elliot Norton and all the fine Boston critics. And then she was going to do a 8 plays in repertory and work on it for 3 years. She had a huge grant for that, and I was going to be part of that. And then I rehearsed with her for 3 months, and she abandoned the whole thing because she felt the company wasn't good enough, which I don't think it was. And so I worked with her on The Seagull. I worked with her in other roles in the fall. And then at Christmas, the whole thing was collapsed. And then I went on to do the seagull with the Luntz. I don't believe it. When I laugh, it's because it's like some fairy tale.
Now, you worked with Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine on Broadway in The Seagull. These are like great names of the theater, but most people today have never seen them perform and know them only through legend. What were they like? What was so special about them?
Well, they were an enormous influence on my life. They just, if I say only one thing, of discipline. I've never... what they pounded into me in terms of theater discipline has never left me. And I've tried to pass that on because I'm very shocked most of the time at young actors who don't understand what a disciplined performer is like in terms of the simplest things of your own health, of your rest, of your readying yourself for work, of the hours you put into work. I can work 12 hours in a row and not fall down. And the respect for the craft, for the love for the theater, the need to make it into a true offering for an audience. I mean, I knew some of these things before, but they were kind of reconfirmed, and I saw it in practice. They were phenomenal.
When you say they taught you discipline, could you elaborate on what it was that they taught you that helped you with discipline?
Well, they were disciplinarians in the toughest sense of the word. You were, if your curtain was at 8:30 in those days, your half hour was at 7, at 8, you were in the theater at 6:30, and not a moment later. Somebody like Clarence Derwent, who was the president of Equity at one point, very prominent actor, played with them in The Pirate, and he played the part of the pirate who didn't appear until the third act. That was at 10 o'clock. He was still in the theater at 6:30. And the no-nonsense backstage, never, you don't drink during the day. You don't come to the theater in a messy state. You look after your costumes. Miss Fontaine used to sit with me trying to teach me a decent makeup, which I'd had classes in for years. And she would smack my hands if while I was putting on my eyebrow pencil, said, no, no, no. She'd say, you make up for the, not for the last row gallery with opera glasses, but for somebody in the front row with opera glasses. And that's what I'm talking, and how that you don't have on a beautiful costume and have a malted milk and spill it in your lap. In other words, everything had to do with true care about everything you did and everything you brought to a performance.
In 1943, you played Desdemona to Paul Robeson's Othello. What was it like to work opposite Robeson?
Well, it was wonderful. He was an unbelievably overused term, but charismatic man with a great presence, an enormous intelligence, a sense of humor. He was a great, great man.
Was there anything that was considered controversial about the production?
Everything was considered controversial. That's why.
Because so often Othello was played by a white actor in blackface.
It was the first time in this country. No, mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe in some. I just was trying to think who else had played it. I don't want to have history cockeyed here. But it was for a Broadway production. Way ahead of its time in that sense, and that made it very controversial and very exciting, and no trouble at all. Everybody was thrilled with the idea that this was finally happening.
Now, am I right in saying that you were later blacklisted?
Oh, yes, I was blacklisted for 10 years.
And
as a matter of fact, I was graylisted in 1970. I did a production for CBS, and I said to, there was a woman producer called Barbara Schultz, and I said, did you have any trouble getting me on? And she said, oh, God, yes. That was still in 1970.
And do you think that related at all to your work with Robeson?
It did.
And your friendship with Robeson?
It did, no question about it. I also was a progressive and a political, I still call myself a liberal, left liberal Democrat. I always was, and I always will be. And it was that one time in my life when I would say I was very proud to be an American citizen because I felt I was very active as such. And the blacklisting and the what happened to me as a result, I say the government still owes me an apology.
So you lost a lot of roles that you think
well,
you would have had.
Well, of course. Yeah. Oh, I know. And it was at the kind of the most fruitful part of my career. I had just done Blanche for 2 years. I had done The Country Girl. I had done St. Joan. And suddenly, and I was beginning to get big television offers. I was never got another television. I never got another film offer. St. Joan was supposed to go on the road. I couldn't go on the road because they were writing the Guild protest letters from Indianapolis, from all over the country. And the worst thing they did, I don't really care, I say, about that, because I think, in a way, maybe it prevented me from being tempted by movies and stuff that I would have been sorry I did afterwards. But what they did to me spiritually was that it's the only time in my life I was ever frightened. I've never been frightened of anything in my life. And that scared me, and that's what I resent most.
Did you have to testify?
Twice. I mean, I was called twice. I only testified once eventually in private session. But those were horrible days. Those were days when you sat in a restaurant, and if you started to talk politics, you looked over your shoulder to see if a waiter was listening was going to report you. My phone was tapped. I was followed by the FBI. And nobody ever even asked me to be a communist. That's what's so ironic about that whole time.
Uta Hagen recorded last year. Sunday, she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Kevin Spacey is up for a Tony Award for his starring role in the Broadway revival of The Iceman Cometh. Coming up, a 1991 interview with him. We also continue our interview with actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen, and John Powers reviews John Sayles' new film, Limbo.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1998 interview with actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. Sunday night, she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. Hagen runs the HB Acting Studio and is the author of the books Respect for Acting and A Challenge for the Actor. She started her career over 60 years ago and worked with such theater legends as Eva Le Gallien, The Lunts, and Paul Robeson. In 1947, you worked with the director Harold Clurman, and you say that he took away all your tricks and brought you into a more modern approach to acting. What were the tricks that he stripped you of?
Well, the tricks, what you learn, actually, he stripped me of stuff that I had acquired as a professional, which was pretty junky, you know, the Broadway tricks. You tell a funny joke just before you enter the stage. That makes you into a professional, which is junk. And slick entrances and how to sit and how to move gracefully and self-aware and theatrically, externally theatrically phony, which I did not begin with, by the way. As an amateur, I said, Clurman led me back to being a good amateur, which is that I believed who I was, I believed where I was, I had faith in what I was doing, I was not dishing it out front for consumption, and he wouldn't let me do. I had learned to fix line readings, to fix gestures, and he didn't let me do any of that, and I got back to where I'd been, and I only now I believe that it could be done that way and wasn't amateurish, but was true.
You met your late husband, Herbert Berghoff, in the theater. He was an actor and teacher, and you run the studio that he founded. Did you meet him in a play? Were you on stage together?
Yes, we were in a play with Clurman, as a matter of fact. It was the same play called The Whole World Over by Konstantin Simonov. Not a very good play. And he was a replacement, and I had heard about him, and through many of my acting colleagues, many of them studied with him. I thought he was a phony, he was a guru. At the few meetings I had with him, I thought he was a strange man. And then we started working together, and were love scenes, and a couple of kisses, and a couple of hugs, and a week later we hit the sack and we never left.
Now, 44
years later.
I imagine it's a very kind of intensified experience to be in love with somebody on and off stage, to enact this dramatic love on stage and to also feel it off stage.
I don't think it's that so much. It's working together. I think it needn't have been a love scene for us to fall in love with each other.
Uh-huh.
What was extraordinary about our relationship from then on was that we truly did everything together. I mean, he'd got me into teaching. He's the one who started me teaching. And I said, I don't know how to teach. Why do you want me to teach? And he said, you know how to act. Can't you learn to pass on what you've learned? And when he put it that way, I thought, that'll be fun. And then from then on, I loved it. And we had the studio together, and we played together for many, many years. And he directed me in many plays. And it was a unique, fabulous life that I still can't believe is gone.
My guest is actress and teacher Uta Hagen. Did you ever study, you know, the method?
No, never. I mean, I've read all of Stanislavski's books avidly when I was young, and I still have my old copies that are all underlined with "so true" on the side. You know? I didn't really know why. And I also remember thinking, why can't I do what he's telling me when I get on stage? As a matter of fact, when I was asked to write my book, I was actually commissioned to write the first one by Macmillan. I said, it can't be done, and it drove me crazy, because I said, I can demonstrate something in 1 second that it takes me 30 pages to write. You know, got so bored with it. But my books are actually based on things that gave me problems as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And every exercise, thing I came up with was based on my own problems, sharing those with other actors, which I think most of those problems every actor has had himself. When people say, oh, how do you know that? I say, because there isn't a mistake I haven't made. There isn't a mistake in the book that I haven't made 10 times, 100 times. So then I see it in someone else, then I can help them get rid of that problem.
You mentioned that first book about acting that you wrote. You've in a way disavowed that book, and you have a second book about acting. What was the problem with the first book?
Well, when I was watching an exercise in class, and I was appalled, and I very rarely get impatient, and this time I did, and I said, my God, what's the matter? Didn't you read my book? And she said, yes. And I said, where does it say to do what you just did? She brought me the book, and there was some sentence there. I said, oh, no. And I hadn't looked at the book in 12 years. I took it home. I reread it. I said, this has got to go. And I immediately started to revise it and spend another 5 years writing the new one. And theoretically, I agree with many of the things in the first book. But it's cute. It's superficial. It's convenient. I think it can be misinterpreted. I teach all of it. I've taught a lot in colleges. They say, I'm working from your book, and they're doing the opposite of what I say. They have managed to say what I wrote and interpreted the opposite. So I thought, this mustn't be. So I wrote the new one, and I think you might not know, people might not like it as much, but they might disagree with it. You can't even disagree with the first one. It's so general.
I wonder if you have actors who you've taught, who you've seen changed by working in Hollywood and achieving stardom there.
I've seen, if they're talented and manage to get over the idiocy of Hollywood, they usually change for the better. But if they improve, but if they, I've seen professional actors. Stars whom I worked with who were theater actors who were quite extraordinary and wonderful. And they go to Hollywood for 6, 7, 8 years and they do sitcoms or they do nothing but movies. And they come back and they are scared to death. They cannot sustain a performance. They tense up. They have not used their bodies. They're all used to close-ups. And have really lost their ability. And that's a fact. I know 4 very specific examples that were you shudder.
Uta Hagen, recorded last November. Sunday night, she'll receive a special Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement. Kevin Spacey is up for a Tony. We'll feature an interview with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kevin Spacey is up for a Tony Sunday night for his performance in the leading role in the Broadway revival of Eugene O'Neill's The Iceman Cometh. Spacey's competition includes Brian Dennehy, the star of the revival of Death of a Salesman. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Kevin Spacey, recorded in 1991 before he became a movie star. His films include The Usual Suspects, L.A. Confidential, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, and The Negotiator. Spacey has a very high charisma level, as you can hear in this scene from The Negotiator. Samuel Jackson plays a police hostage negotiator who has taken hostages of his own. Kevin Spacey plays the ace hostage negotiator that Jackson has requested to negotiate with him. Here they are, face to face, with Jackson speaking first.
Need to reopen negotiations.
I'm sorry, you want something from me?
I want the electricity turned back on.
You want something from me? You think killing a man gives you the power to negotiate with me? Why is that, Danny Roman? Because you think you know me? Because you think you can trust me? Because you think you know what I'm going to do, that I'm going to give you time? Don't you... And count on it. Right now, I'm the only thing standing between you and an army that's just itching to walk in here and take you out. So you tell me something, Danny.
Why should I get in their way, huh? Make me believe why I should deal with you ever again.
I still have hostages. They can still be punished for your mistakes.
What was that, a threat? Did you just threaten me? That's all I need to walk out of here, Dan.
The rules of engagement state you don't risk a breach if the hostage taker is willing to kill in retaliation. And I think I've proved I'm willing to do that.
One more gun goes off, and I'm going to give the order to move in myself. You understand? Don't think you've bought anything by asking me to come here. Because you need to remember, I am a stranger to you. You have no idea what I'm capable of.
Kevin Spacey plays an honest law enforcer in The Negotiator. He played the bad guy in the role that many of us first noticed him in the late 80s TV series Wise Guy. Here's Spacey as Mel Prophet in Wise Guy, a twisted drug dealer and corrupt businessman with a thing for his sister. Here he is pulling a gun on the hero of the series, undercover agent Vinny Terranova.
Do you like roulette? One round, six chambers.
Come on, Mr. Prophet, I think maybe you got a nose full. Don't do this.
Not cocaine. Rule one, don't inhale the retail. What I take is medicine, Jack. Prescribed PX formulas. Dr. Feelgood's number 9. It doesn't put me to sleep, but it makes me feel a whole lot better. Round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows.
You've done theater and movies, but really, I think your breakthrough role in terms of public recognition was on Wise Guy, in the role of Mel Prophet. Did you expect that would happen on TV?
One of the reasons that Wise Guy intrigued me, both as a character and then in terms of how we approached it, was I felt that I'd watched so many actors play bad guys as sort of slick and antiseptic and kind of cool and in control, that because Mel was so bizarre as a character, that when you're playing a character like that, the parameters are much wider. You can get away with a lot more. I felt that if we could approach it almost with total abandon, which isn't done all that much on television, certainly in series television. And as I say, I must give credit to Steve Cannell and David Burke, because they really gave not just me but the whole a company up there in Vancouver, we were there for about 6 months, a sense of complete freedom.
You've said that you wanted to meet with Cannell before taking the role, and you wanted to tell him that you wanted to slowly build the character, and that it might not be clear right from the start what you were doing.
Well, yeah, Stephen didn't understand. I turned down the show at first, and Stephen didn't understand, you know, who this young pup, virtually unknown New York stage actor, was turning down a major role on a primetime series. He just couldn't figure me. So he thought, well, and Steve is a very smart and intuitive man, and he said, well, will he come in and talk to me? And I said, sure. So I went in that night. This all, by the way, happened in about 12 hours. I went in that night after I'd met him in the afternoon originally, and we sat and we talked for an hour. And I'd had a couple of experiences doing episodics as a guest, and they weren't very good experiences. And while I thought that I might be able to do something, I was afraid that the same kind of conditions would be at play on this show.
What kind of conditions?
Well, a lot of times if you're a guest on a TV series, you find that, in particular if you're not known, if you're starting out, you find that there's a lot of line producers who sort of stand behind the camera asking a lot of questions about, why is his hair like that? Or why is he wearing that tie? What's he doing with his face? Why doesn't he just play it the way God? And it becomes very confining as an actor to have someone there who is not necessarily artistically inclined making decisions and judgments. And on Wise Guy, because I felt that the character, I thought, this isn't going to be something that I walk on the set on the first day and decide how to play. This is something that I want to have evolve and grow over these 7 episodes, and it ended up being 9 in the end. But I thought if... I said to Stephen in this meeting, I said, if you let me do what I think I can do with this role, you're going to think that you have an actor who's completely lost his mind as you watch the dailies, which are what they watch every day of the film that you've shot, because it won't make sense to you. And it might not even make sense in totality, but I think we'll be able to do something that will be interesting and unique.
I'm interested in finding out a little bit about you. You were born in New Jersey, but you grew up in Los Angeles. Tell us something about your childhood. Why did your parents move? What did they do?
My father was a technical procedure writer, and he worked for corporations as diverse as Rockwell. And what that means is, very briefly, the guys who put together the F-16... they have to put it together with a manual, and my father wrote that kind of manual, not the F-16 in particular, but as an example. And my mother was a private secretary. She worked at Busch Gardens out in California for a number of years.
Busch Gardens, oh boy.
Yeah.
Did you go there a lot?
Are you kidding? I had more Budweiser sweaters than I can count.
Oh boy. I've always figured, you know, you can't afford to go to Europe, but you can go to Busch Gardens.
That's
right.
That's right. And I started when I was, I went to school out there. We moved around quite a lot. I think it's one of the reasons why I feel at home wherever I go, because we moved so much that I had to make wherever I went in my new home. And I started a theater in junior high school. A guidance counselor suggested that I take a drama course, and I did, and they can't stop me yet.
Have you ever been very brash or aggressive about getting a part or getting an audition?
Extremely. I would not have done Long Day's Journey and Tonight with Mr. Lemon had I not taken no for an answer. When that play was being cast, the people who were casting it didn't feel I was right for it and wouldn't see me for about 8 months. So I finally went to a series of lectures that Dr. Jonathan Miller was giving stole my way into a party in his honor and got enough courage to sit in a chair next to him at one point and talked for about an hour and convinced him to see me for the part. And I did. 2 days later, I had my first audition, and he cast me. And that was in 1985, and I hadn't done really anything up to that point that merited me getting that role, except I'd done my work in preparing for it over those 8 months. And it was really, for me, a breakthrough experience.
What were some of the things you told him when you got his attention that you think convinced him to give you an audition?
I think basically he understood what I had been going through in terms of trying to get an audition. I think there are you know, sometimes people in this business, in this industry, who think that directors want big stars and big names for parts, and when in fact they're just really looking for the best actor for it. And so sometimes it's hard to get over those hurdles, and I think he just saw in my eyes and understood the struggle that I'd gone through in trying to get an audition and was sympathetic to it. And we had also talked for at least a good 40 minutes before I ever even brought up Long Day's Journey. I just got to know him a little bit and chatted, and I think out of that as well was what he decided to give me a shot.
Did you ever do stand-up comedy? I think I'd read that about you. I don't know.
Yeah, you've done your work here. Yeah, I did, in California, actually. I did stand-up comedy for about a year and a half in clubs and bowling alleys.
Bowling alleys?
Oh, unbelievable. And let me tell you, when you're doing your best material and there's not a peep, and then you hear the sound of bowling pins being knocked over, it's really so encouraging.
Well, I don't know if you'd really find your audience at a bowling alley.
Boy, I'll tell you. Well, at the time, I was doing an imitation of Johnny Carson in my act, and I realized that people who were at bowling alleys for midnight talent contests don't watch Johnny Carson, so they had no idea who I was doing. They were absolutely clueless.
What other stuff did you do?
I did a lot of topical material. I even actually, somewhere on tape, ABC did a pilot for a series called The Comedians, which was something that they'd done in Granada Television, done in England. And I hosted it as Johnny Carson. And somewhere there's a tape of this thing that we did in 1978. I was just out of high school. And occasionally, for benefits and things, I'll bring Carson out again because he's so much fun to do. And he's difficult to do. I find a lot of comedians who I watch do him do a very sort of high profile Carson. It's very high comedy. They're impressionists who have to be identified. Their characters have to be identified in the first 10 seconds. And I approached Carson a little bit like an actor. I went sort of underneath. And in fact, I was going to do... I did the Carson show, and it was a big thrill to do the show because I used to hang out at the Tonight Show and watch him live almost for an entire summer to learn how to do him. I didn't get a chance that night to do him because I ended up only having 3 minutes, but they promised the next time I'm on that Johnny and I will meet. and you know what? Nobody will care. It'll be a weird thing, but...
Oh, yeah. So why did you give up comedy and go into acting? Was that your plan all along?
It really wasn't a plan so much as it was just the way things turned out. A friend of mine had come to New York and attended Juilliard and had been encouraging me through letters to, if I was really serious about acting, I should come and audition. And I finally did and was accepted. And I think I just decided that... I think I understand why actors, why people like Robin Williams and Steve Martin... Billy Crystal have gone out of stand-up comedy and ended up becoming actors. I think because stand-up comedy has so many limits to it that as a performer you just ultimately feel that you need to break out of it. I mean, I was never in their league by any measure, but I understand the idea of wanting to and I was always an actor. Stand-up was sort of a sidelight, but it was ultimately an incredible experience and absolutely terrifying.
Kevin Spacey, recorded in 1991, he's up for a Tony Award Sunday night for his performance in the Broadway revival of The Iceman Cometh. Coming up, a review of John Sayles' new movie. This is Fresh Air. Independent filmmaker John Sayles has a new movie. It's called Limbo, and our film critic John Power says that's where it left him.
Let me tell you what I like about John Sayles. I like his independence and integrity. I like the way he puts political ideas into his movies. I like the way he tells stories about the working people that Hollywood ignores. I like the way he films in parts of America you never see on screen, places like the Texas border or West Virginia coal mines. I like the way he doesn't give a hoot what people like me say about his work, and having once interviewed him, I like him personally. In fact, I like everything about John Sayles, except his movies. Now, if you're one of his loyal fans, and after 11 earlier films you'll know if you are, you may well enjoy Limbo, which displays his usual idealism and sense of geography. But if you're not, this new movie highlights much of what's unsatisfying about his work. Limbo takes place in an Alaskan fishing community, where canneries are closing and champagne-guzzling yuppies dream of turning the area into a tourist mecca. Sayles regular David Strathairn plays Joe Gastineau, a gloomily decent ex-fisherman who's been tiptoeing through life ever since an accident 25 years earlier. He perks up when he meets Donna DeAngelo, played by Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, a small-time singer who's come north looking for work. Donna's dragged along her alienated teenage daughter, Noelle. That's Vanessa Martinez. The three seem prime for a kind of redemptive family psychodrama. But the story suddenly pivots when, after trouble on a boat, they wind up stranded on a deserted island well off the beaten track. Now their story is about survival, and the clash between Donna's life-affirming optimism and the existential glumness that suffuses both Joe and her daughter. It's long been an article of faith that Sayles, unlike a studio hack, writes rich, complex, character-driven screenplays. But in fact, his scripts lack the mess and mystery and unpredictability of life. They're all about making points. This whole movie is crawling with caricatures. The angry fisherman who lost his boat, the transplanted lesbians who own a shishi restaurant, the deadpan Native American like Marilyn from Northern Exposure, and the smug developer who literally talks of turning Alaska into a theme park. They're all sociological types, and horribly acted, I might add, who exist solely to make it seem that we're getting a sharp portrait of a changing Alaska. But the movie's social observations are as glib as the interaction between Joe and Donna, whose byplay owes less to real life than to the tradition of Hollywood banter.
Never slept with a drummer.
Is that good?
Probably indicates some level of self-respect I've never fallen below.
So, ex fishermen rate higher than drummers.
There are certain types of fungus that rate higher than drummers.
To put across the script to Limbo would take a great director. But a dozen movies in, what's most frustrating about Sales is that he's still so lousy at thinking in pictures, to use the title of a book he once wrote about filmmaking. Although the movie boasts the great cinematographer Haskell Wexler, there's not a memorable image in it. In fact, most of the staging is as clunky as a home movie. And the acting's grotesquely uneven. Although Master Antonio knocks herself out to bring Donna to life, she even shows off the singing voice of a small-time crooner, she's pulled down by the doleful performance of Strathern, who's refined his trademark stoic minimalism to the point that he now resembles a barnacle. In the end, Limbo wants us to see how Joe and Donna and Noel are transformed by being caught on the island, how the extremity of their situation leads them to transcend pettiness and learn to bravely accept their destiny, even if it's a dire one. This is a perfectly reasonable theme, but in an exasperating touch, the movie builds to a Cape Fear-ish life-or-death climax and then doesn't show what happens. When the movie premiered at Cannes, Sales spoke about this open ending as if it were a daring artistic gambit. Real daring, one viewer snarled, just like The Lady or the Tiger.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Roberta Shirok. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture, and from Bantam Books, publisher of Rose's Garden by Carrie Brown, a novel about love and redemption, available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two young gay people who founded gay groups in their high schools after they were beaten up by students. We meet Kelly Peterson from Salt Lake City and Michael Bassanio from New Jersey. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.